Like millions of baby boomers, award-winning science writer Katie Butler lived thousands of miles away from her aging parents and assumed they would enjoy long, robust retirements before dying peacefully at home when the time came. Then one fall day, her seemingly healthy and vigorous 79-year-old father suffered a stroke that left him unable to finish a sentence or fasten a belt without help. His wife became his full-time caregiver, bathing him, feeding him, even brushing his teeth. A year later, to correct a minor heart arrhythmia, cardiologists outfitted him with a pacemaker. In a moment of hurry and hope, the device kept his heart going but did nothing to prevent his slide over 6 years into dementia, incontinence, near-muteness, and misery. Katie Butler tells the story in Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death, and we welcome Katie Butler to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I very much appreciate it too, Joe.
It seems as though there are a lot of questions that you wanted to explore and a lot of issues that you wanted to bring to the forefront for discussion in this book.
Yes, thank you. I think my father's long decline and death was a wake-up call for me. I had been already a science writer, writing a lot about psychology, and I'd been a journalist for nearly 30 years, so I thought I knew what was what. And our family found ourselves bewildered and kind of in the grips of medicine in a way that we had not anticipated. And so after watching my father's very slow and painful, endless decline, and then watching my mother's very, very brave and fairly swift death, because she faced her own death very head on, I really couldn't rest till I understood why this had happened to us. And that turned out to mean understanding pretty much the whole of American medicine as it's organized now, and even looking into the history of how our culture has dealt with the question of the approach of death.
When you think about that approach to death, I mean, it's safe to say that we're not good at it, right? We're good at planning pretty much every aspect of our life.
Yes.
Except for that.
Yes. Well, I think there's two sides to the question, and one's the side of us as individuals and as a culture. And we're kind of victims of our own success, which is that in the 1950s, we developed so many different means of saving lives that we really lost the bright line between what is saving a life and what is just prolonging a dying. So because our medicine has been so effective and so wonderful in terms of saving lives when it's really appropriate and needed to save lives, I think a lot of us have kind of gone into a dream state that we're just like never going to die at all. And of course, human beings have been terrified of death probably since the beginning of time. But now we have kind of good excuses for being terrified because we are so effective with our medical technology. And so we've lost the ancient spiritual tools of how to contemplate and approach our own deaths. So, for example, in the 1450s, the best-selling book was called Ars Moriendi, which means the art of dying. And it was literally a how-to guide for the deathbed. And those traditions continued in the West until the 1800s, and then those books fell completely out of fashion as medicine became more successful at preventing sudden and random death. So there's that side of the coin,
right,
which is that as individuals, we are afraid of death, and we want to avoid thinking about it. And then, unfortunately, there's also the other side of the coin, which is that we have a medical system where it's, sadly enough, actually profitable to many people within that sector to overly prolong the dying process.
You saw two very different views between your father and your mother. So your father's life was prolonged by this surgery. And meanwhile, your mother rebels against the doctors. She refuses open heart surgery and ultimately wants to do it the old-fashioned way of face her death head on.
Exactly. I think part of it was luck of the draw, because if you have a horrible stroke, you know, you're going to have a prolonged decline, pacemaker or no pacemaker. But part of it was just who my mother was. And I like to say this, you know, this is not simply a grim book, because I think she was actually a real hero. And the end of the book is really about how courageously she faced her death.
Absolutely.
So she had two leaky heart valves. She declined open heart surgery because of very real risks of stroke and dementia, serious risks of cognitive decline after open heart surgery. And so she really knew that she was agreeing not to try to live forever. And I actually called her up and said, "Are you sure? The doctor says you could live to be 90. And she said, "I don't want to live to be 90. Your father was my best friend." And of course, he was dead at this point. And so she really had 5 months to prepare for her death. And she did it both completely practically and emotionally. She cleaned out the basement. She fixed a broken window. She told a friend that she didn't plan to leave a mess for her kids. And this is at a point where she's suffering very serious heart pain. And she kind of knows the end is near, although she doesn't know exactly when it's going to be. And she also reconciled with my brother. She also told me that who she, you know, she said, "I want you to give my sewing machine to a woman who really sews." And, you know, she had a very good sewing machine, and she was, you know, she was that kind of, you know, old-fashioned housewife, extremely effective housewife. And so she really had the opportunity, like our ancestor did, which was to prepare for her death, to face that it was coming, and to kind of clean up her life so that she could leave her descendants in peace.
One of the things that I found fascinating in reading the book, and both of my parents have both passed in the last 4 years.
Yeah.
So, and I lost them within 3 years of each other. So I look at this, and I was reading the book, and the thing that is hard to digest for anyone who has been through it, which is, you know, a lot of us, is that you have to ask the question at some point, or I think most people ask the question at some point. If so many people, if you ask the question in your healthcare proxy, or what do you want done, and they say, "I don't want to suffer, I don't want to be a vegetable, I don't want to have a prolonged death," and yet that doesn't seem to make much of a difference in the way that we as a society and as a culture and as a healthcare system deal with the issue.
It's really strange. There's such a huge disconnect that 3/4 of people want to die at home, but only 1/4 or fewer do, and 1/5 die in intensive care, which is to me an absolutely horrifying statistic, because it's the death that almost universally nobody says, you know, "Put me in intensive care and let me die tied down with tubes coming out of me and unconscious," you know. And I think that there's sort of two factors here. And one is the fact that there's a fear of litigation on the hospital side, because they even have a phrase called the nephew from Peoria. And this is the estranged family member who flies in at the last minute. They're very unresolved with their issues with the parent or whoever the loved one is. They insist that everything be done because they're not ready to let go because they feel so unresolved. And the hospital or the doctor, quite understandably, is afraid that that will be the person who comes back and sues for wrongful death. You know, "You didn't do everything to save my mother," even if my mother is 92 and suffering greatly. And I've actually talked to doctors in the course of writing the book who have said to me, "You cannot imagine how traumatic it is to be trying to revive a 92-year-old person, give them like CPR or put a respirator down their, you know, a tube down their neck." And the person is literally saying to them, "Please don't do this to me." But the family is so unprepared, and the family is insisting that everything be done. And so, unfortunately, even if you've got all the right documents signed, if you have disagreement within your family, you may end up again at this fate that you really don't want. And so to me, one of the takeaway points here is you need to get your family on the same page with you, which may mean resolving some emotional issues that have been sort of shoved under the rug and not really dealt with. My feeling is that when you think you're within the last 5 years of your life, or when someone you love is within the last 5 years of your life, that's actually the time to start having these very meaningful and important conversations.
With that said, even if everybody's on the same page, it can still be a rough road. It can be a very difficult road. And I have a my wife's grandmother, who is 95 years old. The last 4 years, she has suffered Alzheimer's, has been in a nursing home with no clue as to where she is or who she is. And every time we visit once a week, she says the same thing to us upon our arrival and upon our departure, which is, please let me die.
Yes. And it almost makes the hair rise on the back of my head to hear you say this, because I know so many of us are being faced with these difficult, difficult decisions about when to treat and what not to treat. And for example, with your grandmother-in-law, the question comes up, if she gets some kind of an infection, are you or are you going to not treat it with antibiotics?
Right.
You know, if she can't swallow anymore, are you going to refuse to allow a feeding tube? Now, very few people know that the U.S. Supreme Court has declared that you have the constitutional right to refuse any medical treatment, even a treatment that the doctor thinks you need, even a treatment that will keep you alive longer, or to ask for the withdrawal of any treatment, to take out a feeding tube, to take out a pacemaker, disable a pacemaker. You don't have to take it out. So there's a tremendous disconnect here, and this may seem odd for me to do since I'm trying to talk about my own book, but there's a very small pamphlet by a hospice chaplain called Hard Choices for Loving People that I highly recommend, that goes through all of these various treatments that can make a natural or sudden death impossible. And very sadly, quite a few nursing homes have as a protocol that if you collapse, they will call 911. And if they call 911, the chances are 99 to 1 that there will be an attempt at resuscitation. That person will end up in an emergency room and possibly an ICU, experiencing this terrible ICU death. It is possible, however, to sign on behalf of, let's say, your grandmother-in-law, documents like do not transport, which means do not take her to the hospital, let her stay in the nursing home. But if you don't have those documents signed, the nursing home or the hospital may feel that they are potentially going to be legally vulnerable.
You know, and beyond that, and I was thinking about this while reading the book, which is that you can't, even if, I mean, in our case, those papers have been signed and we were all together, and my grandmother's wishes were known to us, and she declared them, and so we were in good shape. But it even challenges your very spirituality. What kind of compassionate God would allow this to happen?
Wow, that's a big question, and I really agree with you. It's an enormous challenge to our spirituality, because our ancient religions really don't have a language for the choices that we are facing now. Like, what religions often talk about filial devotion and supporting your aging parents. But the idea that it could be the loving choice to say no more medical care or don't call 911 no matter what is really, we're sort of forging a new spiritual path here. And I think very, very deep in our bones, both spiritually in most of our spiritual traditions, as well as I think just evolution has evolved us in this direction, we have a very, very deep belief that life should be regarded as a blessing, and for many people it's also regarded as a gift from God. And it's like trying to turn the Queen Mary around to say, okay, we've come to the point where life is a curse rather than a blessing, and that the loving thing to do here is to allow this person to die rather than deploy this incredible medical armamentarium to keep people alive endlessly. We had a case in California fairly recently where a woman collapsed at an assisted living place. She was in her late 80s or early 90s, and there was enormous uproar because nobody who at the assisted living place gave her CPR. And so why did you let this woman die? And the poor nursing home, I mean, it wasn't the nursing home, it was assisted living, but they were essentially pilloried in the press for letting this woman die. But the reality is a lot of older people are like what your grandmother was saying, which is that they literally say, why aren't I dead yet? Why am I still alive? Mm-hmm. And I think we need to really listen to them, you know? And I frankly don't blame God for this. I blame the fact that we have a medical technology that has run away with itself. And the watchword within the medical profession is, if we can, we must. And so I think that we as human beings have a lot of responsibility here. I wouldn't put it all on God. Mm. We have a lot of responsibility here to be the rulers of our technology rather than to be ruled by our technology. And obviously this is an issue that's far beyond just the medical issue. It's like, it's also true with our cell phones. You know, are we going to be run by our cell phones, or are we going to run our cell phones and turn them off when we want to do something different? And I think it's the same with the medical technology, that essentially we can, I remember a doctor saying to me once, I could raise a blood pressure in a bowl of Jell-O with the drugs that I have. That was what he meant by the extreme to which you could go to keep the minimal functioning of a body going. And in such a situation, we really need to take command. We need to take back our moral authority. And I think we need to understand the terrible bind that the doctors are in, so that even the doctors that, there are many doctors who want to do the right thing, but there are fears of litigation. There are enormous economic pressures that actually make it financially penalize doctors for doing the right thing. Like, I mean, to give a simple example, my father had a hernia surgery and the pacemaker put in. And those two surgeries together cost $22,000. But the family physician who was against the pacemaker would only have been paid $54 to discuss whether putting the pacemaker in was a good idea or not. Mm. So we have these enormous financial biases built into the system now that unfortunately really promote bad deaths and penalize the providers who try to provide good deaths. So hospices are incredibly underfunded, and interventional cardiologists make $450,000 a year.
The subtitle of Knocking on Heaven's Door is The Path to a Better Way of Death. We're just about out of time, but I am interested in you explaining this slow medicine movement, which is very similar to the slow food movement in many ways.
Exactly. I see fast medicine as throwing tests and procedures at people and seeing what sticks and hoping that that creates health. And that's the system we have right now, which is doctors are very overworked and don't have enough time. And so rather than spending time talking to a patient, they order a bunch of tests and go on to the next person. Slow medicine really values the quality of the relationship with the doctor and taking time to make wise decisions. So, for example, with my dad, if we had been practicing slow medicine, or we'd had a slow medicine doctor in the picture, lucky enough to have that, we would have taken time with that pacemaker decision, which was made in basically 15 minutes. The doctor would have fully explored the pros, cons, and alternatives of the surgery. We would have explored the question of the fact that this device had a 10-year battery and really asked my father if he wanted to live another 10 years in the state that he was in. And slow medicine could say it's the quality of the medicine you're getting and the quality of the life you're living that we care about, not necessarily the quantity of your life or the quantity of the medical interventions that we throw at you.
The name of the book is Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. It is published by Scribner. Katie Butler, it's a beautiful book. I thank you so much for your conversation and your time this morning. It's a great pleasure.
Wow, thank you, Joe. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed it myself. And, you know, I wish you the best with your grandmother also.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Again, the name of the book is Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. It's published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.